Hi, I'm Jason Nias from Digital River, an e-commerce and payments company dedicated to helping brands go global and grow their revenue. But this isn't about us. This is Commerce Connect, a podcast about people who are creating some of the best e-commerce experiences of our time. Listen on to hear from e-commerce visionaries as they look back on where they started, lessons they've learned, and what they believe will be the future of online shopping. Hello, this is Jason Nias with Digital River. How many times have you wished for a way to look into the future to understand what your business needs to prepare for right now? Well, I'm excited today to have a few guests who can help us do that. They are from Future Commerce. I'm joined by two co-founders, actually, Philip Jackson and Brian Lang. And Future Commerce is a really cool digital resource that focuses on a podcast, newsletters, and research, which is all supported by a collective of e-commerce experts who've helped global brands build their own digital channels. So I'm excited to have you two join me, and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Jason.
Thanks, Jason.
We're actually rebuilding our about page on futurecommerce.fm, and I'm just going to steal all of that verbatim.
Do it.
Perfect. I'll email it to you.
Yeah, it's fantastic. No, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I got to know you gentlemen because you guys host one of the internet's most popular or at least best resources on e-commerce. And I was a guest on your show. I jump ball, Brian or Philip, I'd love for you to give us a little bit of your bio and talk a little bit about who is Future Commerce.
You want to take it first, Philip, or should I?
Yeah. How could I turn it down? Yeah, Future Commerce. We about 5 or 6 years ago, Brian and I used to work for competitors, and we found ourselves having really interesting and sort of heated conversations about what the future looks like. And is there some sort of an eventuality that we're all heading towards? Certainly e-commerce was, you know, top of mind back then, but the way you built it back then was a little bit different. And we seem to be on this precipice of a lot of really new and interesting types of commerce development. You know, conversational commerce was like a really big trend at the time. And we saw a lot of APIs that were sort of leveraging this sort of multi-checkout, big focus on going global. And all of these changes all seem to be happening all at the same time. We said, why isn't anyone talking about the future of commerce? And so Brian and I started a podcast as I guess was the norm back in 2016. And we quickly realized there's so many other ways to be able to connect with people. Certainly podcasts are one media form that people like to engage with. But these days, over the years, we just started adding new channels. So these days, you know, we write essays, we perform original research, as you mentioned, and we are, you know, also in the newsletter trade. And it's been quite a wild ride. But Brian, do we disagree as much these days as we used to? I don't know if we do.
I mean, maybe sometimes. but we really, I think the unique angle that we take is commerce touches everyone.
Yeah,
and therefore commerce kind of can change the world if we do it together. And so that means that we're looking, I think, past just the best practices and the driest strategy that you might find in other reports out there. And we really want to make it about human connection and about ideas and about, you know, what's next. And I think and about art and leading with things that actually are meaningful to people. And so that's been a big part of who we are and the type of content we put out. And I think that's a pretty good summary between the
Perfect.
Two of us.
Let's see why we have a tough time rewriting our about page.
Well, you guys, what I appreciate about both of you two gentlemen, is that you've got your head in the cloud, which you obviously should because you're futurists, but you also have your feet on the ground. And your backgrounds really lend itself nicely to the role of the companies you founded. So can you give us a little bit of background on, and maybe we'll start with you again, Phil, around what led you to this point? What experiences did you have in your professional career? What customers did you work with, and what type of roles did you have?
Yeah, so let me sort of give you a the perspective is really shaped over a long period of time, right? So I've been in this industry for almost 20 years. First 10 years of my career, I was on the brand side, and we had, I worked for startups. I worked for what you might call today digitally native vertical brands, companies that, you know, manage their own supply chain, manage their own manufacturing, whether it was domestic or international, had a really strong line on the import business, very, very early player to Amazon Subscribe and Save in the wellness industry, very early on to Amazon 1P, and just we had to solve problems by building custom software because that's how you did it back then. And being on, you know, both a private equity backed track of growth, and also in a small venture backed company, I had sort of a perspective that, you know, was very early on, and being an engineer in the trade kind of gave me a little bit of a leg up early on. Now, you know, these days the world's changed quite a bit in the last 10 years. After the last company I was with sold to a public, you know, what we'd call a roll up these days, I found myself wanting to help more people at scale. And so I went to an agency, as, you know, a lot of people do mid-career, and I went to the professional services side. And the thing I realized was that was the differentiator. It wasn't technology, and it wasn't brand, and it wasn't even quality of materials. The thing that kept our customers coming back when I was in direct-to-consumer was our excellent customer service and the relationship that we had with our customers. And I realized that was the differentiator in our services business as well. We were probably more expensive than others, but we delivered exceptional service. We treated our customers the way we would want to have been treated ourselves. And I'm realizing that here in the media business, in the media industry, ton of newsletters that churn out, you know, $15, $10, $15, $20 a month subscriptions, do they have the kind of eye of on service and hospitality and having a relationship with their audience that I have become accustomed to having over the last 20 years on both the brand side and on the services side? You cannot compete in the services industry without having an exceptional white glove mentality with holding on to a customer. And I'm proud to say, you know, we learned how to hold on to customers for 8-10 years. And so I think we're doing it a little bit differently. And like Brian said, I think it's really about that human connection. Can we really divine the future? I don't think so, but we're all building the future together. Like, we're actually in the midst, in the trenches every day, actually building what will become the future of commerce. We all have our hands to the plow, just like you do at Digital River. You're actually manifesting the future.
I really like the psychology aspect of the way that you guys operate your business. You said something that resonated with me, and it was really around the interdependencies of our industries. And if we specifically tie it to e-commerce, you know, back, I've been doing this for 20 plus years, and ecosystems are a relatively new concept in the world of e-commerce. It wasn't for the last, you know, 10 to 15 years. It used to be a world where there wasn't such interdependence. If you wanted something, you built it out and you figured out how to solve those problems yourself. But now in this world where everything's an app in an ecosystem, you're now reliant on many different technologies, many different partners, many different things working together. You guys see that as well? Anything you want to add there, Brian? Because the psychology around deal control, around how you manage customers' expectations, those are all psychology angles.
Yeah. Actually, before we get to the psychology angle, I think what you said resonates with me very strongly. And I'll tease out a little bit of something that we're going to be talking about in our upcoming visions report, which is actually your customer experience is really not just you. It's actually made up of a whole bunch of experiences that other people have built. You are 100% reliant on a whole map of other technologies that have been built. Now, interestingly enough, in the past 2-3 years, these sort of stacks have all started to become and look really similar to each other. We've all picked the same technology pieces or similar technology pieces, but the thing is, your brand is not your own. Like, your business is not your own. These days, it is actually fully dependent on these other pieces that you've connected and built built out, that your customers are experiencing, whether or not they know it, is a different story.
I mean, just to like put some skin on the bones, if you wanted to like make it real, the UGC on your website, you know, your product ratings and reviews, sometimes just the checkout itself, or even just the payment buttons, elements of maybe even your homepage, or that video that you sourced from an influencer. Those are all parts of like vital customer experience and decision making that a customer is working their way through. And that is not real estate necessarily on your website that you cultivated and planted and seeded and germinated and grew. Like, that's stuff you brought in from elsewhere. And, you know, it's something that we're sort of calling the quilt. Right. And unfortunately for quilts, you kind of stand back and a lot of quilts all tend to look the same. Right. you get up close and elements of quilts, you know, can become distinct and apparent. And so we're noticing that, you know, through a little bit of an exercise that we did and some research, is, you know, as much as 30% of a customer journey in a website can be governed by these third parties and you know, that are operating as ecosystems now. And that's a lot of real estate to give over control of over to, you know, another company. And from an engineering standpoint too, you know, you're putting a lot of trust in those companies to be up and available and work in all the time and be fast.
it's not necessarily a bad thing. It just goes to demonstrate, like, it is becoming more and more interdependent. Like, the customer experience is dependent on other pieces more so than ever. And we talk about composable commerce these days and other things that, you know, it's like, okay, hold on. What does that actually mean for your customer? Not just you as a business and what you're building, but for your customer.
Can I pitch you, Jason, a little bit on, like, there's upsides and downsides to this, right? The upside is we have an accelerated way to be able to deliver on these really high expectations for customer experience. So that's super positive. Another one is, as platforms have become sort of more capable and they've sort of coalesced around a core set of features that most everybody needs, that means that you can be successful on pretty much any platform that you choose. It also means that we have this sort of homogenization of customer experience, that most everything tends to operate the same, which is like in itself a little bit of a double-edged sword. You don't have to retrain your customer on how to shop with you because they know how to shop online, right? That's really powerful. But it's harder and harder to stand out too in a sea of sameness where you have hundreds of thousands of brands that all look like and operate just like you. So really does that, then it comes down to expensive, you know, things that are more immersive. It's more photography, it's more video, it's more shoots. And those are things that lie outside of the purview sometimes of the person who's running the e-commerce channel, is dependent on that kind of creative to be able to succeed. So these things become really complex in an e-commerce business. And I think just recognizing that complexity is key to understanding like the time that we're all in. Sorry, go ahead,
especially Brian. As customers are becoming more and more complex themselves and recognizing that they're more complex. Like I literally just had to tweet, and Philip kind of called me out on this. Like I lost to the multiverse. I hate the multiverse. But the multiverse won. But I think the multiverse is just like this whole idea is so embedded in our culture right now that there's like everything is more than it is, like more than it is by itself. Like there's multiple
that's
versions.
Deep, Brian. That's deep, I know. That's deep for before 5 o'clock. I'll tell you.
Oh man.
I think Plato said that. So that's good.
Yeah, Plato's a big did. Fan of the multiverse. You know?
Oh man.
you know, I think you're right on the 30% of the site is other technologies, but I think probably 30% of the pixels, but 70% of the utility. You know, how you capture payment, how you do reviews.
Totally.
All right, of that.
We're going to quote you on that. That's great.
Go for it. Take it. It's got to be higher. But you know, you talked about the quilt, and I think that's really apropos. I think that's right. And in your step-by-step podcast that I was honored to be on, you guys took a view on cross-border. And I think the fact that you had to do it in a multi-interview with many different experts kind of demonstrates your point. Can you talk a little bit about that podcast step by step and maybe give it a little bit of a commercial so people can decide if they want to tune in?
Yeah. So Step by Step is a mini series that we do quarterly at Future Commerce. And it's usually a deeper dive, you know, deeper than a 101 or 201 level. It's like a 301 level dive to help what we say is to get you from, you know, zero to hero on a one particular topic. When we launched it, it was around a natural state of curiosity that we had in how businesses get funded. There was certainly, you know, in 2017 and 18, there were a number of, you know, these, you know, large direct to consumer, you know, fundraises that kept hitting the news, and we want to understand
still happening
a little better. Still happens to some degree today. Numbers are certainly a thing to behold. But when you take one particular topic and you sort of explode it, there's, you know, there's generally a B, C, D, E, F, G. There's like a stepwise way to explaining a really thorny topic and putting it into a context that a diverse audience cares about. We don't just have merchants that listen to the show. You know, we have folks from all over the ecosystem. And even if you are, you consider yourself to be a merchant, your style of business really matters, right? So you could be a retailer, you could be operating a marketplace, you could be pure play e-commerce, or you could, you know, have a wholesale business that, you know, thrives and, you know, has but services grocery, and that's very different to something in apparel. So trying to really tell a well-rounded story requires a ton of effort on our part. And you know, thankfully we have an amazing team, and we bring an ecosystem of experts like yourself on to help us get a little bit deeper. And it, again, some people don't just connect with audio. And that's where I think that we're bridging a bit of a gap, is that we're also creating these in-depth guides. And so in our cross-border partnership with Avalara, this quarter, we produced a 40-page illustrated step-by-step guide on how to go cross-border. And that is, you know, that requires us to have a command of the subject matter and to wrangle a whole bunch of points of view. And but it's worth the investment on our part, because not a lot of folks in our ecosystem are trying to explode these thorny topics. What they're doing is they're being extremely reductive, not to criticize, but you know, a lot of it is like marketing fashions and fads that come in and out of style very quickly. You know, last year it was all about live stream video, and a couple years ago it was all about subscription and reducing churn. Rather than following fads and fashions, you know, our approach is take the things that are general truisms and try to demystify them and give people, you know, a step-by-step guide.
And well, and sometimes that takes a little bit of time to tell that, because they are complex issues, like cross-border in particular. And the season that you came on for, Jason, season 7 of Step-by-Step was like a long story to tell across multiple people. From several companies, including Avalara, including Digital River, including BigCommerce, right, and Flexport, yeah. And Kent Allen came on, which is amazing, because
that was cool. It's funny, we get to meet our heroes too, you know, because we've been in this for so long. You know, there's certainly some names, you know, the Kent Allens or Scott Silvermans of the world, you know, people that are. You know, the shoulders of titans on which we all stand, people who really paved the way for us. And that's been a really great part of this. But when you cover something like, I mean, cross-border, honestly, when you consider the upstream effects of supply chain and how much even just the consideration of going cross-border can affect supply chain, like we are having light bulb moments ourselves when making this content, because say what you will, a lot of people are talking about polymathism and, you know, being a generalist these days. I've been doing this for a long time. I've implemented cross-border many times over. I had no idea the complexity on the supply chain that going cross-border can create. And so that's the kind of thing we're trying to tease out, is there are no best practices. Everything kind of ends up in it depends heavily on what you're trying to do. But hopefully we can educate and make it a little clearer in the process.
Yeah, especially as it relates to cross-border, because it's all about the trading pattern, the product you're trying to sell, from where you're trying to sell it to where you're trying to sell it, at what price, at what weight, at what it's made of. There's so many variables that, yeah, cross-border is, I love the way you guys do it, because it's such a meaty topic that if you try and do it in 30 minutes to 40 minutes in a podcast, you're just going to be Pollyanna. You're going to be obvious. You're never going to get any sort of real depth.
You know, we too are experimenting as a media, you know, as a small bootstrapped media company in a niche area of, you know, of digital experience. you know, we're experimenting, trying to find the things that our audience cares about and where we're, you know, the future products that we build. And so this is also part of our journey is, you know, we're learning and we're curious, but we're trying to find that intersection of what our audience, you know, needs the most and what they need right now.
Right on. Well, talk a little bit about some of the topics that you see on the horizon. You guys are future commerce. You talked about conversational commerce. You talked about composable. Where are we at in that journey? What's in the future?
There's a lot coming right now. There's an idea that I am exploring right now, and hopefully I'm working on my next Insiders article, but it's basically the idea, this idea of the deconstruction of the customer brand relationship. And this is an idea that's a little bit half-baked still that I'm trying to work out in an article. But the idea is that in these past 2 years, we've seen sort of more distance between brand and consumer. Between 70 and 90% of communication is nonverbal. And if you look back at, you know, I hate to draw on philosophy here, but like the idea that like language is imperfect in itself, like it's very difficult to have a relationship solely through words and images even. And so there's some interesting article in The Atlantic about this that I'm going to be referencing, as I'm prone to do, and about how a relationship that's like text only, like it disintegrates over time. And the idea that is that this all relationship right now is trending towards narrative. Like you brands and customers are only what they represent themselves as opposed to actually what they are. And so instead of having a real relationship, it's just narratives interacting. And so this means that brands need to invest in narrative-driven resources. And so
that's powerful. So I haven't heard any of this. Brian's just using you as a guinea pig to workshop it.
I am.
I like it. But unpack it for me. But what does narrative-driven resources mean? Like web, social? Is it around better pictures?
Yeah, no, it's all of those things. It's around people that are able to tell stories that are self-aware and that are very clear, that are compelling. And because the narrative is going to sort of live outside, like it's going to interact with the narrative the customer brings as well. And so as those two interact and they almost live outside of the actual brand and the actual customer themselves, like that narrative, the only way to like continue the relationship is to have the narrative continue.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
There's if you were deep into, if we had like our ethereal theme music wrapped around this and maybe you hit a really fat blunt right before you started listening, then I think a lot of this starts to make sense. You're also like the thing that is really tough in our space is what everybody wants you to say is we're going to have more chatbot automation in the future.
Right.
And the fact is that consumers actually have these wild reactions to something that's being pushed upon them as opposed to something that they're demanding of you. The thought leaders on Twitter will tell you live stream commerce is here and it's here to stay. Just look at what's happening in Asia. Not a single one of them have ever bought from QVC. They couldn't possibly tell you what a consumer that looks for a live stream, you know, purchase experience wants, because they are not that consumer themselves. And so I think to say something is going to be a thing as a physical manifestation is a little bit of a red herring. What we all can agree on is that it's really difficult to predict what future customer expectations will be. If you can compose your business in such a way to be able to sense what those are and react to them and be nimble enough to be able to put those into place, I think that's the real, that's the thing that we're all going to have to focus on, is building more resilient businesses that are able to adapt to change. When we talk about like generational businesses, Jason, what we talk about is businesses that have survived existential shifts in the way that we interact with them. Microsoft used to be a operating system company. Then it was a desktop computing, computer in your home. And then it was a video game company. Now, you know, they have
firmly enterprise
productivity business company. So when you're talking about that, and I could do the same with Facebook, you could do the same with any of these generational large, businesses. They buck the trend of existential crisis. They are able to overcome, these massive and monumental shifts, not just in technology, but in the way that consumers react to us. I think we're on the precipice of a shift that, and I took over for Brian, I'm sorry.
No, this is great.
I think we're on we're on like this really knife edge at the moment where people, the number two e-commerce site in the world is a company called Shein. And Shein is the antithesis of everything that we're told is best practice in e-commerce, right? Number one, there's nothing sustainable about Shein. Shein is producing fast fashion at a apocalyptic scale. They are a massive company that basically were incubated in China, not as a venture-backed company that grew in 5 years, but as a 17-year horizon. They've been in business for almost 2 decades, and they, my friend Jeremy Kai from Italic likes to say, they basically grew up on planet Krypton, and then when they came to the United States, it was like, they find themselves having Superman powers because what they do works really well for Western audiences. Their design is frenetic, right? There's no clear call to action anywhere because everything is vying for your attention. Every single part of, if you're a product owner at Shein, it's just make everything loud and let it scream at you and hopefully someone interacts with it. So when you look at the things that are starting to resonate with a future consumer, my concern is that there's less clear paths for us to be able to build and mimic. And mimicry is actually how this whole industry has thrived. There was a whole era where 5 years, we were just building whatever Amazon did, assuming that it was successful. And so my concern is that, our new standard bearers, our heroes in the industry become these companies that are actually, frenetic and not necessarily great for the world or for the environment. They're certainly focused on overconsumption. And it makes me kind of curious as to what lessons we learn from them and which parts of what they do are what we glom onto and start to integrate and to implement. And then I think the consumer too is signaling to us that they don't care as much about the things that we think they care about as they do. They sometimes just want really good product and they don't want to hear about how you're changing the world or how you're making them better in the process. I think so. There's a knife edge, and I think it could tip either way very easily. Is the consumer just doesn't care. They just want stuff and they want it for a fair price and they want it pretty quickly. And they want to be able to brag about it to their friends and use that to, signal their ideals and their affiliations and their social groups. That's what they care about. And that's really kind of sad, to be honest with you, because I wish it was more, but it's not. It's a lot of things all at once, and that could be the future that we're all heading towards.
So how do you consult companies on that? I mean, you just said a lot, and it was really, really interesting and a little bit controversial. So I really like that. But what does the conversation look like when you sit down with brands like you do with Future and also in your other day jobs and have that conversation?
And Naval Ravikant, I don't know if you're familiar, was quoted as saying, of course, he built AngelList and is a prolific investor a Twitter god. But he said something kind of controversial that I think sort of follows in this vein, Jason. He said, you're marketing because you failed at product, and you're doing sales because you failed at marketing. And if you had a stellar product, people will put themselves through anything to get it. I sat for 3 hours on Gap.com's broken ass website trying to buy a Yeezy puffer for $300. And I'll tell you what, I put myself through it and I hated every minute of it. But if I won that freaking jacket, I'd be a pretty happy dude. People will put themselves through anything for really good products. And I think we've lost sight of that, especially in the direct-to-consumer era and those, Insta brands, things that are very easy to build and source from overseas and slap your pretty brand on top of, we sort of lost the fact that, hey, your ramen's beautiful, it tastes like garbage, dude. Like, we have to have really good product. And really good product overcomes a wealth of objections. It will find its natural audience and people will go bonkers over it, and you'll have to do a little less work in the process to save a customer from churning. That's really hard to do. And I think that's why we don't do a lot of it. We want the one weird trick. We're going to slap a subscribe and save button on it and call it a day and go pay for some Facebook ads, because that's a little easier. I think doing the hard thing is actually the thing we all need to get better at. And if you're just moving ones and zeros around, you may not even have control over whether that product that you're selling is good or not. And that's kind of also scary.
So that's another thing that I think we're going to see is like more connection between product and content and marketing. It has to get tighter. And organizations have not been set up for the level of connection that's required to have that, the feedback loop between an actual like sale and feedback all the way back to product, and like being able to revise based on that. Like there's a lot of departments that has to go through before it actually hits the product department. So there's going to be a lot of organizational shift. It has to happen for businesses to keep up in the coming years.
Yeah. It's such a balancing act. I mean, I saw a chart once that talked about Tesla's marketing budget was like near $0 when rounded, compared to GM's, which was astronomical. And they said, basically, we put all our money in R&D and products because we know you'll want them and you'll find them and you'll buy them. It's kind of aligned to your conversation. I don't own a Tesla, so I didn't fall for it yet, but.
A lot of people have. I also think that Tesla does a lot of marketing simply by exposing the things that they're doing. Like that's kind of what we're talking about right now, actually.
Well, there's now the product roadmap is news and people can read it. And so it's like advertising.
Right.
I think it's also a good example of, you know, extreme outlier and a, probably, you know, I don't know. I'm going to get myself in trouble on this one, but I firmly believe, you know, there's something that's really novel about a business like Tesla is you have, you know, something that in the open source world we would have called a BDFL, benevolent dictator for life, right? You have to have someone who has a very clear vision and a voice that will basically, you know, move the masses to action. And certainly you have that in Elon Musk. I think Jack Dorsey in Twitter is another good example. You know, having a really clear leader who has a pretty keen vision on what it is they want, whether or not they could be polarizing, you may not like them. I certainly, you know, we are quoted in 2018 saying we're never going to talk about Elon Musk on our podcast ever again. That didn't age very well. But, you know, it's one of those things where having someone with a very clear vision who can help to lead a group of people is something that a lot of us sort of miss out on. Especially in the age of, you know, big roll up holding co's that, you know, sort of just own a mess of brands that don't really have a clear vision. So I think that there's certainly extremes there. If we had people that were really passionate about the products that they're creating and they see themselves as being able to create a legacy out of it, I think they're certainly probably more prone to be more product minded than they are around this sort of marketing and hype vehicle, although Elon could be accused of having done both quite well.
Yeah. Well, I will say this, the other side of the coin is I've met many, many companies who've said they've put almost all their money in great products. And if they could just get the word out, they would and life would be good. And a lot of those have failed. So it wasn't necessarily just product led. So I do think there's a level of sweet spot that businesses are trying to find.
Yeah. Oh, I certainly agree. I think that's the other part of it is how do you advise a company on just being lucky? I think a lot of success just comes down to timing. You know, both Brian and I sort of grew up in the Magento era of e-commerce, and you know, I've often said that, you know, Magento was just 2 years early. If Magento had come around 2 years later, a lot of decisions would have been made, a lot of capital would have been unlocked, a lot of things would have happened differently that would have probably, you know, it would be the dominant platform today, but it didn't work out that way. And that's just how things work. Not to say that like it was not a success, I think would be a complete mistake, because it was capitalized three separate times by three organizations and is now powering a not trivial part of GMV for a lot of big enterprises. And I certainly still make my money on, you know, Magento and Adobe integrations to some degree. So to say it's not successful, I think is also a bit of a mistake. Like these things can be successful, but do they have to have like, you know, same outcome? Success only measured by,
I,
you know,
I also think that
recognition. Go ahead, Brian.
There's so much more to unpack here, but like a lot of businesses are realizing that like getting in front of people doesn't necessarily mean you in front of other people, which is what a lot of the best practices around marketing are about right now. It might mean having other people get you in front of other people, which means wholesale and distribution channels are actually really coming back into vogue, because there are incredible networks out there that put product in front of people. And if they put your product in front of people and it's good, and you know that, then it's gonna work out really, really well. And so you're seeing like larger plays towards getting into existing retail networks, curators and the like. You know, I saw Ghost in my local Kroger recently. I feel like that was probably a better strategy than every single dollar they put into DC in recent years. So I think it's about, you know, obviously it's about achieving critical mass and other things like that are required to get into those places. But I think that people are looking at old traditional ways and like, oh, wait, this is why that was done that way. We kind of maxed out our arbitrage opportunity on digital. What are other ways of achieving mass scale?
You can see it when you see D2C brands who were carrying the flag of D2C showing up at your local Nordstrom's,
right,
or, you know, whatever. So it's happening. What's old is now new again.
It's so true. Can I say one last thing on that topic?
Sure.
There's also like, don't discount taking the long game.
Mm-hmm.
We're always in e-commerce, you know, in particular in the last couple of years, you know, we've seen a lot of growth, and a lot of companies in 2022, just as they saw in 21, are going to have they're going to be tasked with trying to comp up on numbers over the last 2 years that, you know, might be really tough to attain because there were tailwinds at the time for digital purchasing that, you know, you're going to have to compete with the world on, you know, on an accelerated reopen rate, you know, cross your fingers, COVID permitting, and all that good stuff. So, you know, maybe take the long game. Maybe not all of that, the growth has to happen all in the next 3 to 5 years. I mean, you know, look at nursing and look at FedEx and Pilot programs these days. You know how they're, you know, planning for their own future industry growth is they're going to elementary schools and telling kids how cool it is to be a FedEx pilot. And it's the same reason that McDonald's, you know, put a play place inside, you know, their restaurants in the 1980s. Like, we want to set something in people's minds to sort of plant the seed for the future 15, 20 years from now, that equates an emotion or a nostalgic feeling with the interaction with the brand. And you can't just do that. You can't incept people to having that feeling, you know, in 2 to 3 years. Sometimes that takes a long, long time. So yeah, it's the reason why Balenciaga makes video games now, right? It's all of that really kind of comes down to multi-pronged strategies to creating like an enduring business that can last for a really long time. Really hard to do that in space of a year or two. In fact, I can't think of a single example that was done in the space of a 2 to 3 year period. Certainly, not in the last 2 to 3 years.
Well, the McDonald's point hit home with me. I grew up in a small town in Iowa, and we had McDonald's with a playground. And I remember basically telling my parents we're going to that instead of Burger King because of that playground. So 100%. I'm totally with you.
Yeah.
Worked out for them. Well, let's transition a little bit to some of our wrap-up items. The first is, you know, I would love for the Digital River Commerce Connect listeners to really get in touch with you and your brand. What's the best way to do it? Visit the website, sign up for the newsletter. What do you guys recommend?
Yes, please. Futurecommerce.fm/subscribe. Go there. That's the place to start. Obviously, the podcast you can find on any major podcast player, whatever you use. You can also subscribe to us there, but I would love to have you subscribe to our email list. We send out a lot of additional info via our email chain. We have two incredible email series. One's called The Senses, which really covers what's happening in the world and our thoughts on it, commentary. The second's called Insiders. That's a long form essay that we write and put out some of our other bigger reports through and guides and more and news about events and dinners that we're doing. And so, yeah, definitely go subscribe.
Fantastic. And then, you know, obviously this will be my wrap up question, but I would love to hear from you as to where, if people were going on Twitter and follow one person who you think is kind of cutting edge, interesting, someone to pay attention to, who would it be and why?
Barack Obama.
Sure. Get political. I'm cool with it.
No. I honestly feel like we would all do better. And this is not an original thought. Michael Miraflor, who is a really a smart person who sits at the end. He sits these days. He does Gen Z research, but he dabbles in the art world and is certainly known to trample around the D2C spaces a bit. He has a famous saying, which is like, unfollow influencers and models and start following more artists. I feel like we could all be more creatively inspired, I think, because of his sort of stance there. I think Michael Miraflor for me would be the instant follow. And you're going to get a little bit of everything from him. He's brilliant. And also a little bit, you know, experimental. He certainly dabbles in the art community and NFTs as well. So you're going to get a little bit of everything.
Excellent.
Magdalena Kala for me.
Say it again.
Magdalena Kala.
Magdalena Kala.
Yeah.
She's
crypto investor.
Yeah. Crypto investor, spent a lot of time at DDC. She's super fun, super smart. She's been on Future Commerce before. She's got fun takes. She's an enjoyable follow. And also you learn a lot when you follow her.
Outstanding. All right. I'll add them both to my Twitter follows. Thank you for the recommendation.
Wait, can I add one more? Greifeld. Sure. Alex Greifeld from No Best Practices is another phenomenal follow. That's a must.
First name Alex, last name Greifeld.
Greifeld. You guys picked really complicated. There wasn't like a John Smith you could recommend for him.
Sorry. I think that's the other thing too is, we're sort of the, I joke and I don't want to do it on your podcast at, you know, the expense of your audience, but it's easy for us to recognize too that, you know, we're sort of a little bit of a trope. You know, there's a joke about white guys that start podcasts in our industry, sort of self-important, needing to get their thoughts out into the world. And one thing that we're trying hard to do is to, if we have any sort of a platform or voice, if we can make space for other people who sometimes get overlooked and maybe marginalized, that's a thing that we really care about too. So certainly trying to help, certainly between Magdalena and Michael Miraflor, we already have, they far eclipse our audience, but it's an important thing for us to help try to point to other voices that are, saying more important things than we are.
Excellent. Well, I follow both of you as well, but there you have it. Brian Lang and Philip Jackson are the co-founders of Future Commerce and hosts of the podcast with the same name. You can find Future Commerce podcast on all major listening platforms, as well as their Future Commerce website. Brian and Philip, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Commerce Connect podcast, brought to you by Digital River and edited at Matriarch Digital Media in Minneapolis, Minnesota. To learn more, head to digitalriver.com.